Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We are going to talk about, could eating honey be a form of microbiological time travel? Cloves stopping the growth of several cancers. Avocado blocking cancer cell growth and protecting your heart. And acetylcysteine supplements benefiting your heart. And raw olive oil boosting brain function, among other health statements. Always my statements are made based upon quality independent research at major universities and published in peer-reviewed literature. And why do I do that? Why, for example, do I give you a study and say where it was published and where it was done? Because we have people every day coming to the radio program or going to the website, and I want them to have confidence the information we share is credible, has been vetted for accuracy, and we don't just allow anything on this program or on the internet. And I want to thank the 1,600,000 visits in just the last week alone. So we're giving you the best we can. Also today, what would help us stop ISIS? I'll share my own opinions as well as Peter Van Buren's on the best ways of stopping the terror spreading. Also, I want to share my own point of view on what I saw not discussed and why I believe that the debate, the Democratic presidential debate, was extremely limited and very, very biased. Also today, time permitting, we will look at the deposer-in-chief, Hillary Clinton in Honduras, from Dennis Bernstein, and I believe it's time that we took a look at this woman's record as Secretary of State to see what did she do around the world that either helped or hurt us. And once you see some of the things she has done, not just in Libya, but Syria and other places, and especially in Honduras, you'll think, wow, not very good. Also from Professor Paul Craig Roberts, the 21st century, an era of fraud. He should know. He was a former professor of economics. He was a former senior editor and reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and he was also the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under Ronald Reagan. Also, from our environmental segment, air pollution's killing millions of people and threatening global health systems. Who says so? The World Health Organization. A toxic threat is killing off Europe's killer whales and dolphins. Half of U.S. fracking industry could go bankrupt as oil prices continue to fall. Those are some of the things on that end. Plus, we're going to share a couple of audio clips that I thought would be inspiring. One is it is from Jill Stein. I believe that Jill is an intelligent, articulate, compassionate, and really populist person. But you wouldn't know it because she's been excluded from the debates. That shouldn't be the case. So we're going to hear from Jill Stein today. We're also going to hear about the Federal Reserve. It's just 7 minutes long, but it gives you the beginning of a story of the biggest robbery ever enacted on the American public, and it's time that we paid attention. Also, former drone pilots denounce as morally outrageous what goes on with the killing with these drones. And if time permits, Ben Carson, you're quoting the Bible again. Better read it before you quote it. I've read it. We'll quote the other part of it. Also today, William Pepper, who has done more investigation on the death of Martin Luther King and who was behind it than any other person on the planet. He will return today for a short newsmaker segment where I will question him on his statements to see whether or not he has proof of everything he is claiming, because he's making some interesting claims. Let's begin. I have seen in so many Italian homes, sitting on a table, not necessarily at dinner time, but any time, a plate of olive oil in the middle, and then you have homemade breads or some croutons or some form of, let's say, grilled zucchini or grilled peppers or grilled tomatoes. And these are just snacks where we might reach for an unhealthy snack. The older Italians reach for healthy snacks. Now, they have olive oil there that I've tried. In fact, I watched them press it, and I have olive trees also. I grow olive trees. It takes a long time. You can wait 20, 30 years before you get your first olives. You have to be very patient, but it also depends upon the climate and the quality of the soil. But then it's what do you do with that? And it's getting the right oil. I've seen oil that when it comes out, it looks like and actually tastes like car oil. If you've ever smelled car oil, changing the oil, this really extra virgin olive oil. It depends upon the variety of olive, that's what it's like. But it's extremely healthy. In fact, it's one of the healthiest things you can put in your body are olives or olive oil. This is a new study that was reported on from the Department of Neuroscience, Area Drug and Child Health, at the University of Florence. And it reports that extra virgin olive oil, rich in polyphenols, was associated with strong improvement in coordination, memory, anxiety-related behavior in this particular study. Why would that be the case? Well, it's the polyphenols. Poly, P-O-L-Y, phenols, P-H-E-N-O-L-S. And these are extremely beneficial because olives are fruit. And the more refining, heating, extracting, using chemicals or other process in so many oils, you're going to denature that. You're going to destroy the polyphenols and the antioxidants. That's why you want to get it really extra virgin. Now, to do that, I believe that a great home-based business for someone or a small business would be to bring in, go to Italy, find the real olive oil and bring it in and handcraft bottles so people wouldn't want to throw away the bottle. They want to keep it and offer that for sale. I think that would be a great little business for someone because most people never really taste real extra virgin olive oil. Most of it's adulterated through the organized crime out of both Spain and Greece, and that you're getting soy oil, which is most of it, and very little, or if no, olive oil. So go to the source and get your best. So the polyphenols in the real extra virgin olive oil change the expression of the microRNA, ribonucleic acid, a small non-coding RNA molecule that plays a role in gene expression, and produce profiles similar to those observed in younger elements. And this was reported in the European Journal of Nutrition. Quote from the study, in a nutraceutical perspective, long-term treatment of olive oil phenols could become part of a neuroprotective strategy for the prevention of brain aging mediated by the induction of health-promoting genes and the coordinated modulation of miRNA profiles. Now, in lay language, that just means that by taking the polyphenols in the extra virgin first-pressed olive oil, you're actually creating a younger brain. You're de-aging the brain. So that's so important, and people need help with their brain. And just try to stay away from the cooking oils. Try to stay away from the big box store oils. Go with the small quality variety. That'll help you. Now, there's a nutrient called NAC, N-acetylcysteine. And according to the University of Marburg in Germany, 4 weeks of supplementing with NAC may reduce levels of homocysteine and improve blood pressure. Now, this was 2 randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trials. Those are the gold standards. Now, they use 1.8 grams of NAC, and that would be 1,800 milligrams, and that's about right. And they lowered their homocysteine level by 12%, and it also improved systolic and diastolic blood pressure. This was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Why is this important? It's simple. Anytime you have elevation of the amino acid homocysteine, you're going to increase your risk of cardiovascular disease and death. But it's a silent killer, and people don't know that it's elevated. Anxious people, angry people, intemperate people, temperamental people, generally the ones who have an increase in homocysteine. Or you could be a vegan and not have enough B12 or B6 or folic acid, all of which are important for maintaining lower homocysteine. Now, if you were to take 1 milligram of methylated B12, if you were to take 1 milligram of methylated folic acid, 50 milligrams of B6, and 200 milligrams of trimethylglycine, then generally you don't have a problem. It'll bring it down. So, NAC could save your life. It's inexpensive, easy to find. Get it in 500 milligram and just take 2 in the morning, 1 in the evening. Now, avocados. Avocados are good. I grow avocados. By the way, if you ever want to grow your own avocado tree, which is a good idea, make sure that you cap it at 8 foot, because those will go up to about 30, 40 feet. And after it starts to grow and it really spurt on you, you won't be able to get them. You have to climb up the tree. And I literally this year climbed up about 35 feet out on branches to get these big 2-pound, 3-pound avocados, huge avocados. In fact, you'll see up on my website under health retreats, you'll see me holding a large avocado I'd just gone up the tree to get. And no one even saw them, because you look up and everything's green. The leaves are the same color as the avocado. You have to get up there to see it. Always crop all of your fruit trees at 8 foot. Therefore, the energy goes into expanding it instead of having it shoot up. Because it goes up, then it's too late. And if it does grow too much, after the harvest, after the season for it's over, go in and cut the top off, trim it back, do your pruning, and then nourish the soil the same time you do the pruning. It would be like you getting a really, strong haircut. But it's good for the plant, because then you condense the energy, you constrain the energy. But here's the latest research on one of the reasons we should eat avocado, and this was published in Cancer Research. And this was done at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center in Ontario and at the Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. They found that avocados can block cell growth, cancer cell growth, and protect your heart. Well, we knew that an apple a day protects your heart, but an avocado does the same thing. So why not have an avocado apple salad? Great salad. They're rich in carotenoids and other helpful benefits that prevent cancer and heart disease. And an avocado is great in guacamole. And avocados, by the way, are a fruit. And they're good if you have metabolic syndrome or overweight. They help support healthy joints. They help give you healthier, smoother skin. They improve your vision. And the secret to the cancer-fighting capabilities of avocados can be found primarily in the carotenoids and the monounsaturated fatty acids they contain. Oil not so dissimilar from olive oil, which is a monounsaturated fat. So studies have documented a significantly lowered risk of several types of cancer, including breast cancer and prostate cancer. And also avocados contain the antioxidant glutathione, which protects cells from cancer and are great for your liver. And it's anti-inflammatory. So avocados help turn off pain. So if you have arthritis or if you have fibromyalgia, then avocados could help. But it also helps with prostate cancer, oral and skin cancers. And that's important and can help prevent cancer from metastasizing. In fact, avocados have chemicals that can bring about cancer cell death. And it also helps with acute myeloid leukemia, a rare but deadly form of cancer. So, a delicious way to help stay healthier longer. And finally, cloves, yeah, just good old cloves, according to this latest study, which has historically, by the way, been used in traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurveda medicine. And Ayurvedic medicine is what's been used in India and other countries in that region for thousands of years, and also in Indonesia. They found that cloves are dried flower buds from a plant that's scientifically called a SYZYGIUM aromaticum, and it's extremely beneficial. And what they have done is they found that cloves can help with fight infections, including caused by bacteria and viruses and fungi. In fact, one of the things I used to do in the laboratory is I would take a mixture of colloidal silver, hydrogen peroxide, and clove oil, mix it together, spray it on all countertops, and wipe it down. And it's the wiping that destroys viral cells, but it's the oils themselves that kill bacteria. And also, if you have any form of gastrointestinal disorders, if you have problems with your kidneys and spleen, if you're in pain, clove oil is very important. And but it's really good against cancer. And so it's antibacterial, antifungal, antiviral, carminative, and anti-carcinogenic. And in fact, the University of Pittsburgh, University of Minnesota, China's capital medical university, did a series of experiments, and they found that they tested a variety of human cancer cells in the laboratory using different whole clove extracts. And the researchers tested SKOV3 human ovarian cancer cells and human HeLa cervical epithelial cells and BEL7402 human liver cancer cells and HT29 human colon cancer cells and MCF7 human breast cancer cells and PANC1 human pancreatic cancer cells. They all tested in such a way that clove oil diminished the cancer. So just add clove to the overall types of therapy that can help with cancer. Just one more piece of the puzzle. When they looked inside of the clove oils, they found what is called eugenol. They found B. caryophyllene, humulene, chavacol, methyl salicylate, eugenone, and these are all very important. So that oil has a lot of good that it does inside your body. So have some cloves. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us.
I'd like to welcome everyone
Nice to have you with us. I'm on the road. I'm doing a lot of filming and very important stuff. But hopefully, unless there's a storm or an outage, you'll be able to hear the program just fine. I'd like to share my thoughts about just one aspect of the debate that occurred the other night. First, at the Democratic debate, I take issue with the idea that one of the people, Andrea Mitchell, would be one of the co-moderators, along with Lester Holt. Why? I have nothing against her at all, except for the fact that she has been married to a man who was at the center of so much of our pain and suffering, Alan Greenspan. He spent 18 years as chairman of the Federal Reserve. And to be asking Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders anything about the Federal Reserve or our banking system, knowing that Hillary was called the co-president and therefore her husband relied upon her, and now you have someone that you are friendly with, someone who you helped appoint for 8 years, for 8 years, because your husband said, yes, continue on. Also, Greenspan is a person who trusted Robert Rubin, Larry Summers, who were both secretaries of Treasury under Clinton. And it was Rubin who helped repeal, along with Larry Summers, the Glass-Steagall Act that caused the devastating deregulation of Wall Street. And hence, that led to what now is the collapse that occurred in 2008. And he was the person who was the Ayn Rand apologist. He wrote for Ayn Rand. He did that several times. He thought that she was one of the greatest thinkers of all time. I consider her just a very stupid megalomaniac, but that's my own personal opinion. So here you have Andrea Mitchell, asking about, well, did you say, you know, that Bill Clinton was such and such? And instead of realizing he's not going to be able to say anything because he's already agreed publicly that if he doesn't get the nomination, he will give 100% support to who does, and that would be his opponent. So he's not going to say anything. That doesn't bode well for you to be a senior senator and have the sitting president and all the power that comes with that as your enemy. So he did the best he could to walk around that. And let us not forget that it was her husband who caused 9 million jobs to disappear, costing us over, well, the world itself lost over $16 trillion. And only after all this, when he was asked to testify, did he say, well, you know, we didn't think this was important and then we missed it. He had over 12,000 economists, the so-called best and brightest in the world, to draw from. So they knew that there was a bubble. He knew it. He encouraged it. And then when it collapsed and got out of their control, the people that he had put in positions of power, including the next Ben Bernanke, gave all the banks that were a part of this casino that Clinton was a part of, gave them all free pass, get out of jail free, and gave them a total of $16 to $21 trillion. So you're a co-moderator with a person who your husband had direct dealings with that impacted all of America. Why didn't you ask yourself the question, could I have influenced my husband in any way that would allowed him to have thought through more carefully and more humanely his economic decisions? You can't have it both ways. You should have recused yourself. That, in my opinion, had been the proper thing. Now, as far as what I consider the most foolish interview I have seen in a long time was Charlie Rose. Charlie, if you ever get out of, you know, television, go to work for the NyQuil company. You look like you need a long nap, and maybe some ice cubes under the eye bags. But my problem wasn't that hound dog, I want to go to sleep for a month, look, with no energy. My concern was, there you're grilling Sean Penn, because he had an interview that no one else in the media got. They would have jumped all over that in a heartbeat. You know, Geraldo Rivera would have shaved his mustache if he could have had a chance to have gotten the interview with the drug kingpin. Did I miss something, or didn't people interview dictators, people like from all across the globe who had done heinous things to people, including their own? Had no problem interviewing those people. Why didn't you ask this? What is the legitimacy of the war on drugs to begin with? What would happen if we legalized drugs? What has happened in those countries like Switzerland where they've legalized it and set up clinics to give people drugs and then give them rehabilitation? What has happened with the suicide and death? What has happened with the robbery and burglary in those countries? It has gone down tremendously. What does it mean when you put someone in jail for 27 years in one case for having a certain amount of marijuana, and yet bankers who knowingly commit fraud and launder money from drug kingpins don't go to jail? Now, a specific case in point was one of the largest banks in the world was found guilty of laundering over $800 billion, with a B, almost $1 trillion over the decades, of mainly drug cartel money. And yet not a single person in that whole system was charged with any crime. But if you took drug person's money and you laundered it, you go to jail for 20 years. Why didn't you talk about that, Charlie? Surely the resource staff and researchers over at 60 Minutes are more than capable of doing that kind of hard-nosed investigative journalism. So you let the biggest drug laundering operation in world history, the banks, off. Not a single word. So you attack the interview as if somehow here was this guy. Was it his ego? Was it his sense of self-importance? Look at your reputation. You're not known as a good guy. But you didn't talk about the issues of drugs themselves. For example, how many individuals in the United States have been addicted to painkillers and prescription painkillers and then gone from the prescription painkillers into heroin? It's epidemic. Are these poor people of color in the ghettos? No, they're affluent white teenagers and adults in the suburbs. That suddenly shocks us. I'm shocked. Are you, Rick? I'm shocked. There's heroin epidemic in Connecticut. We're not supposed to have heroin epidemics in Connecticut. Why not? But it's okay to have one in the ghetto? The racism in the media is palpable, but the stupidity of stage programs like 60 Minutes just is numbing. You don't ask one single relevant question about drugs. How do we become drug addict? Why is it that the United States has a dualistic system? We knowingly protect the drug lords in Afghanistan because they were part of the Northern Alliance, and hence we're fighting the Taliban. In return, Afghanistan has the largest poppy crop, hence the largest amount of heroin in the world, and going to the United States. That seems to be okay. We protect the drug lords. We protect, including Karzai's son, brother, and his second in command, a known drug lord. And yet we have a war against people who use the substance that we protect and oversee, that it's grown and gotten out of the country. Is there any irony or hypocrisy here? We see, in fact, when I was asked to do a spontaneous lecture to a group of people in Sedona, Arizona, 3 years ago, and I did, and the room an hour later or 2 hours later was packed. It's the middle of the summer. I was coming back from my spiritual retreat, which I do once a year, where I go someplace in the woods and spend a week alone, fast and meditate. And it was a good group of people. And I asked them, how many people in the room use marijuana. I said, well, I have no problem with your right to use anything. And the essential oils extracted have been shown to be beneficial for cancer, epilepsy, multiple sclerosis, and other conditions, and deserve to be researched and then made into a medicinal offering to the public. But here's a question for you. In Mexico, there's over 80,000 disappearances and over 100,000 killings. That's a lot of people for you to have your drug. When you're doing your drug, and all that comes from Mexico, do you ever have any moment where you stop and say, what is the actual cost of what I'm doing? And if so, do you feel you have any moral obligation to then become a full-time activist and protester and political organizer to at least legalize it so that you will not have drug cartels like the guy who was interviewed or the Sean Penn interviewed, but instead you would not have people kidnapped or killed because you wanted your drug and you didn't think of the unintended consequences of getting it. That wasn't discussed. The massive amount of fraud in the war on drugs was not discussed. The fact that our own Drug Enforcement Agency and our State Department knowingly gave massive amounts of firearms to drug cartels so that one drug cartel could tell the truth about other drug cartels, so we allowed one drug cartel to kill, murder, disappear, behead its enemies with impunity, keep its profits, so we could go after some of the other ones, which didn't do any good anyhow because we didn't do anything. So, Charlie, there's some other issues you could discuss here. Is it any difference taking a medication that is addictive and can kill you and has side effects, including suicide, or taking an illegal drug that someone supplies? Tell me the difference when the end result in both cases could be psychosis, delusions, suicide, or destruction of the person. You made no distinction. You didn't talk about legal drug use in the United States that is the number one cause of death. And so that's why I was disappointed and just trying to make Sean Penn look like he was some flippant, irresponsible person because he decided to do an article. And so you were, what were you doing, Charlie? Having a come to Jesus moment with him? Now, how would I deal with ISIS? First, I would ask myself, has what we've done worked? And someone will say, yeah, we need to do more. Well, according to the latest report, Operation Inherent Resolve, just in the last year and a half, we have flown 9,041 sorties, 5,959 in Iraq, 3,082 in Syria. The U.S. claims it has killed between 10,000 to 25,000 the Islamic State fighters, and yet the latest information from the CIA estimates there are 20,000 to 30,000 fighters still there. So we either didn't kill all that many, or we killed everyone, and then they just recruited all new ones because the numbers don't match. And then what about the civilian populations? For every kill from a drone, 90% are innocent civilians, including women and children. We consider that acceptable collateral damage. And how's that war on terror going in Mosul? Place is completely destroyed. So you liberate it by Janet Reno's philosophy of to save the children, you first have to kill the children. And the Clintons and everyone went along with that. And so they succeeded. Their logic was perfect. The outcome, not so much. So there's nothing that we have done in foreign policy that I can see, and I study foreign policy every day, that we have succeeded at, except we have succeeded in creating the very crisis we're in today. So I would close down these bases. I would get out of their countries And then I would do two things that are essential, or you'll never stop this. I would cut off their funding. There's two ways of cutting off the funding. One is you've got 12,000 trucks loaded with smuggled oil and that go for miles and miles and miles. And you can see them. You didn't bomb a single one. That wasn't by omission. It was commission. From the Turkish border into Syria and Iraq into Syria, or excuse me, into Turkey, you were allowing ISIS to steal oil, sovereign oil, and sell it to make anywhere from between $1 to $4 million a day. So bomb all the trucks so they don't have any way of smuggling oil. Then go to your allies, your close friends, the people who put tens of billions of dollars a year into the military-industrial complex, all those snarly-ass pimps from Harvard and Yale and Stanford and all West Point that are hired down as special consultants because they're so bright, because they've had an elitist education, as if everyone else were just unfortunate to attend a state school, I guess, or a lesser-known school, and not be considered good enough to get into that inner circle. And you've got 200,000 of those companies. You have millions of people. And they need war. They need us to believe their lies. And they've owned the New York Times. They own the media in the United States. And they allow different types of talking heads to tell us what's true. And then we believe it. So why don't you go to those people and say, look, we're sorry, you know, but we're going to go to Saudi Arabia and tell them no more beheadings, no more jailing of people you don't like, including the Shia clerics. And then you go to Bahrain, you go to the United Emirates. There's seven different cities or parts of the country. You go to Qatar, a major, major supporter of terrorism. You go to Turkey. You go to 22 countries and you say, no more. And you hold them accountable. You put sanctions against them. And you say, we will confiscate all monies. We will freeze all your assets if we find that you're funding any terrorist group. And then John McCain will come running out before he puts his teeth in, before he puts his underwear on, before he puts his prosthesis on, before they put a brain, or something they call brain, it's probably a sponge, into his head, and he comes running out and saying, I'm from Vietnam, and I was a prisoner of war. That gives me a right to be stupid today, and you can't criticize me, because I have moderate friends, moderate terrorists. I've taken pictures with them, and they're freedom fighters. Ronald Reagan, he was an idiot, and he had his moderate freedom fighters. They were called the Contras. And George Bush, he was an idiot. I don't think he had any friends. But he said we got to go to Iraq because God told him to, and we did. So just look at all of us who actually caused the world to be a crappy place. We're all a bunch of idiots. We're all retards. But we're in control and we have power, and you don't. Therefore, back off this idea that we should in any way cause our allies, which means we're co-complicit in funding, training, supporting terrorists on a spectrum of moderate, there is no such thing, to severe. Well, we see that. So you cut off their money so they can't exploit resources, and you cut off the funding and training and place safe havens, which are 22 Arab countries, and then you bring together the world's leading clerics, Islamic clerics, and you say, what can you all do cooperatively to disavow their teachings and their distortions of the Quran? And how can you inspire the larger community to actively separate themselves from this type of barbarism? So you have three approaches there, plus getting out of their countries and getting out of their affairs and stopping regime change. Libya would still exist, and you wouldn't harbor terrorists. Syria would not be harboring terrorists. Iraq would not be hiring terrorists. It is not that we have to like the people running the countries or that we're suggesting their Boy Scouts need a merit badge. It's that you better look at the results of what you've done and own it. Own what you've done. And nothing you have done has worked. Nothing. So I believe that it is important that we take a look at this. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Everyone, let's listen in to Jill Stein for a moment, because Jill in this short piece is calling out the rigged debates in the American presidential campaign. Please listen. She is the Green Party candidate.
And, you know, I understand you're part of a lawsuit that is actually suing the Federal Election Commission to open up debates to independent candidates, which is so insane to think that you have to actually sue them for that to even happen. Tell me more about this case and why alternative candidates are excluded.
Well, the case is doing exactly what you said. We're suing the Commission on Presidential Debates for basically rigging the debates. And if you rig the debates, you've basically rigged the election. It's one of many ways, actually, in which the election gets rigged, but it's a very important way. And the Commission on Presidential Debates is assumed by most Americans to be nonpartisan and to be operating basically on essential principles of informing the American public who their choices are. But it's actually a private nonprofit corporation run by the Democratic and Republican parties, and their express purpose is to limit the debate to Democrats and Republicans only. And the American people have gone on record over and over again, nearly 60% in most recent polls are clamoring for a third party option, saying that the Democratic and Republican parties have done such a bad job serving the needs of the people that we need something else. So why not give the American people what they are hungering for? And when the League of Women Voters was basically kicked out back in the 1970s, they went on record saying that the Commission on Presidential Debates is basically a fraud being perpetrated on the American public. So we are essentially suing them to comply with the law. The law says that the debates must be nonpartisan. That's not bipartisan. That's nonpartisan, because there's a very different point of view that most Americans actually share and are demanding. And I'll just share with you one very compelling, you know, experience that made this point to me when I was first tricked into running for office in 2002, when I ran for governor against Mitt Romney and others. We made a lot of noise and actually got into a televised debate. And inside of that debate, I gave voice to the things that I'm hearing from everyday Americans all the time. We should have a right to health care as a human right, a right to quality public education, and we advocate through college. There should be free college. We should be downsizing the military and spending our dollars here at home where we can create true security. We need to respect the rights of the immigrant community and greening the economy to address the crisis of climate change. Those are the things I advocated for back in 2002 in that debate, which was televised and taking place in a TV studio. Those ideas went over like lead balloons, as you can imagine, among the other candidates and the moderator. But when we walked out into the waiting press, I was mobbed for the first time and the last time by the press, who told me that I had won the debate on the instant online viewer poll. And you can imagine that was the last time they did an instant online viewer poll during a debate. And they do their best to keep us out. So my point is simply that the American public is already there. We don't have to persuade people. History has changed people's minds. The public is in a very progressive, proactive mood right now, clamoring for change. If we put that change out in front of people in a debate, you know, hold on to your hat, I think all bets are off about where it might go.
And it definitely sounds like a people-powered campaign, as you're saying. But, you know, for those people who say, you know, if they vote third party, it's a wasted vote. What do you say to them? How do you respond to that?
Well, there's no greater waste of a vote than to keep voting for the two political parties that are throwing you under the bus. And they are clearly doing that. And the Democratic Party, look at its track record. When Barack Obama was elected and we were in an incredible economic crisis, and Democrats had both houses of Congress, you know, he gave away the store, trillions in bailouts to the bankers, allowed the foreclosure crisis to continue unabated, with millions of people losing their homes, continued expanding the wars, the attack on civil liberties, massively expanded the war on immigrants with deportations and family separations, allowed students to go into deeper debt than ever. You know, so it's clear the two parties are not going to do it for us. We need to reject that politics of fear that tells us we have to seal our lips and let the corporate parties do it for us. There's no way, no how they're going to do it for us. We have a choice between a party of people in the planet or a party of privilege and power. This is the difference between the Green Party as a third party of integrity and the Democratic and Republican parties. So we're saying it's time to throw out this lesser evil, time to start standing up for the greater good. We need to lead the way. The corporate political parties are not going to do that. And
I would agree with that. That was Jill Stein speaking up, as she should, to a media and a general public that chooses not to hear the third party or any other fourth or fifth party's comments. And I believe we should have multiple parties, not just multiple people in the same party. Now, we're going to go now to William Pepper. William Pepper is a New York attorney, best known for representing Martin Luther King's accused assassin, who did not assassinate Martin Luther King, James Earl Ray. He was able to prove in a civil court his innocence, and he was found innocent. And he wrote an interesting article in Ramparts magazine. He has had a long history of working on civil rights issues and social causes. He worked with Robert Kennedy. He knew Martin Luther King, and he has spent 37 years on this special investigation. Yesterday, in a two-hour special honoring Martin Luther King and his legacy, I invited William to discuss his 37 years with the research and some of the important insights that he had gained. Nice to have you with us today, William.
Yes, Gary. Hello.
Hi. Now I just want to reiterate a few things and then ask you if you would please to clarify for this audience the quality of your research. In particular, I'm going to ask you some questions, and could you give me the source of your information with the audience here listening to show whether or not it meets the standard of objectivity and or subjectivity, and whether it's specious, speculative, or it's something that people could trust in. Did you personally speak one-on-one with the person who claims they shot Martin Luther King?
Yes, in the course of my research, Gary, and what I said to you yesterday, I want to make it very clear that my statement was an expression of my opinion. And these opinions have been formed over, as you said, over a period of 37 years with respect to my meeting with the shooter. Yes, I did meet with him over lunch. He did not eat, but there was no question in my mind that that he was who he said he was, and in my opinion, was the person involved with pulling the the trigger.
Did you independently verify that he worked for the Memphis Police Department?
Oh yes, that's a basic part of the research. I wouldn't have begun to form an opinion. Establish that.
Okay, did he tell you who had paid him, how much he was paid, and what their motive was in killing King?
No, I didn't get that from him. There were a variety of other sources of information that provided me with details to enable me to form my opinion. One of those sources, I could not use the information for a number of years because he was alive, and I was afraid that it would jeopardize his safety and security. So I held back, and therefore was not able to express the opinion that I ultimately was able to after he died.
Is it your conclusion at this time that J. Edgar Hoover was responsible, along with his partner Tilson, in arranging the assassination of JFK, and Tilson was there on the ground, present and watching and coordinating the police department and those involved in not just the assassination but the cover-up afterwards?
That is a conclusion that I reached, and it definitely is my opinion.
Okay. And you have substantial evidence to support that?
Yes, Gary. I would not go out on a limb, whether a person is living or dead, and make that statement form that opinion unless I had enough to conclude that.
So we're not dealing with any hearsay, but a prima facie evidence, first person accounts, under deposition, under the legal standing that a court would require of an oath taken, recorded information. That's your sources of information primarily?
There were many sources of information, but you've listed some. Yes, there's no question about that, and the opinion gets formed on the basis of the cumulative effect of all of that information.
How many total people approximately did you interview who had information involving the shooting or cover-up?
I would say, Gary, this is over a period of many years. There are at least 2 to 3 dozen people who had various pieces of information that they revealed. Something of this sort, it is rare that you find someone who has all of the information or is allowed to have all the information, and it's usually on the basis of a need to know that particular piece of information are given to anyone involved.
Was the Dixie Mafia a part of this operation?
Yes, it's clearly my opinion that they were in a particular family in that organization.
And you have interviewed members of that family one-on-one, under oath, in a deposition, who had first-hand knowledge of the details.
I have done that.
Okay, good. There was also statements that there were people close to King who you believed, it was your belief, that had betrayed him or had their own self-interest involved. Is that correct?
Yes, it's my opinion that happened in this case, and it shouldn't surprise us. It happens in many cases of this sort.
And the information that you believe in, is that information from a one-on-one with an eyewitness to dealings of some of the individuals that you have a deposition under oath, first person who was witness and still alive and could testify today?
Yes, my opinion was formed on the basis of eyewitness information from people who were in a position to know and to form their their awareness and their intelligence. And it was only on that basis that I formed the opinions that I have. And I'm stressing, Gary, that these are my opinions.
That's fine. I'm interested in the quality of scholarship. I'm interested in the quality of the research, as we've had in conversations. I'm interested in the documentation, because it is in the very near future, in the next several months, you intend to bring additional information forward, do you not?
Yes, I'm weighing that opinion. I'm weighing the possibility of doing all of that. I have only, as you know, with you on your program, expressed this opinion verbally. And I would have to say, Gary, that it's my further opinion that if anyone is offended by anything that I have come to believe, by all means, let me stress, and knowing how fair you are about these things, let me stress that you invite anyone who has taken offense at anything that I've said or anything that I any beliefs that I've expressed with respect to the opinions I've formed, by all means, invite them onto your program and give them equal time or an opportunity.
We do exactly that. It is always my policy, if anyone feels that they have, that there's been a misunderstanding or if there's been a miscastment or misstatement, they always have an opportunity to come on this program and to offer their points of view.
I know you do that. Yes.
I do that, but I also want the audience to know that you have some, what I would consider some extraordinary information firsthand from an eyewitness who's alive today and may come forward at the appropriate moment. And I can promise people from at least what I have, and I will not reveal any, as I gave you my word, I would not reveal it. But I consider what Mr. Pepper has that he has not spoken about, but hopefully will on this show in an exclusive interview in the near future, the most important information that we could possibly No, and no one has heard this. No one in the world knows this except the people who are eyewitnesses. So the information is not specious. It is not speculative. It is not hearsay. It's first person under deposition, under oath, telling exact details and independently corroborated by another witness.
That's right. Gary, I think it's important that your listeners understand that I have not expressed this information. It was not a part of my interview with you yesterday. It has not been covered in the conversation that we had on the air yesterday. And these further opinions of mine have been reserved, although I have, as you know, confidentially allowed you to understand some of the work that has caused me to form the additional opinions, which I have not expressed, but the additional opinions and information that I have developed.
All I can say is this, is if you come on the air and you provide audio clips from your depositions, which you filmed, it'll be shocking. It'll get the attention of the entire world community in a heartbeat. I will not reveal more than that. And we have had an opportunity to share his non-malice opinions. He has approached this as an extraordinary attorney and someone who understands the boundaries of what you can say and cannot say without being, you know, excoriated in the process. But he has documentation, and this is one man who I wouldn't want to get into an argument with on his facts, because he is loaded. So let us hope in the very near future that William Pepper, one of the great attorneys in American history, one of the great fighters for human rights, civil rights, comes on the program and reveals what he has told me for the whole world with the documentation, with not one but two independent firsthand witnesses, and it will make news headlines everywhere. And that's all I can say on it. So thank you for coming on and just giving people some idea that he is simply exploring the facts and laying clear the true record of what happened, because I can tell you from the documentation, from the evidence that he has presented without malice and independently documented from multiple sources who are alive today and will remain, let us say, indiscreet and indisposed. No one will be able to find them. So those people can come forward, and we will lay this out.
I encourage you to do that, Gary. I also encourage you to take everything that I have given to you and discussed with you as a reflection of everything that has caused me to form the opinions that I have with respect to this horrific event that took place on the 4th of April, 1968, but was planned well before that that date. So it's been a very sad and distressing, frankly, experience for me. In some ways, I wish I had not undertaken it, because I'm myself very depressed and staggered by the information that has caused me to form the opinion. But the opinions that I have concerning any number of people who are related to this matter are clearly going to upset some folks. And again, I encourage you to follow your usual practice. And if anyone is upset, disagrees with the opinion that I expressed yesterday, and wants to have their position known, by all means, invite them on and give everybody.
I will. We have an open invitation. I will end with this. Almost everything you've heard about the assassination of Martin Luther King, William Pepper, from his research and his first-person, non-hearsay research, will give you a completely different reality check, one that will shock everyone who knows anything about the artificial, contrived story, according to William Pepper, that we were told about Martin Luther King's death. Thank you very much, William Pepper. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Sorry we ran over, but I thought it was important so people didn't take so lightly what we were sharing yesterday and realize there's a lot of research behind it. Have a nice day, everyone.